This is number 0072, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it's coming to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0072. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Kevin Cook, who is the author of Titanic Thompson, the man who bet on everything. Who was Titanic Thompson?
This is a man who used to play golf for $10,000 a hole, while the best players in the world were playing for $1,000 a week. He was also a great poker player, a dice player who came in and cleaned out everybody in New York City in the Roaring Twenties, a man who killed five different men and married five women, all of whom were teenagers on their wedding day.
Leanne Castellino is a broadcaster and one of the minds behind the website WhereParentsTalk.com.
We started originally as a company that produced parenting DVDs because we felt that there weren't really any credible, trustworthy video resources for parents. And in keeping with the technology and the evolving technologies, we've now moved into online parenting community that has no borders, which is fantastic.
Shergul Arshad is the author of 40 by 40, The Luckiest Sports Fan Alive. He came to the United States as a kid from Italy and immersed himself into the world of North American sports.
As a social way to fit in, you know, as an 11-year-old, 12-year-old, it's really sports and music and not much else. It's before kind of girls kick in, so the other two subjects were music and sports, so I took a crash course on both and was hooked on with sports for sure.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0072, is my very own sister, Jennifer, who, by the way, is also the grandmother of those two nephews you heard on the Meshach and Malik Christmas show from a little while back. Yes. That's their grandmother. Thank you very much, Jennifer, for doing this late on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? And our first couple of stories deal with people who clearly are not quite sure of the concept, especially when it comes to how to properly handle criminal activity. The first one deals with a woman by the name of Anne Simonovich, who is 74 years old. Now, when Anne of Spruce Grove, B.C., told scrap metal yard owner Vic Small why she wanted to purchase an incinerator from him, he didn't believe it. She said she wanted to burn her husband there, which is what he said later. Thinking she wasn't all there, he instead dealt with her daughter, Lori. Now, later, Lori called him back to check the machine because it wasn't working. When he arrived and looked inside, Small found Alex Semenovich, who was 77, or at least was 77, Anne's husband of 50 years, stuffed inside. Prosecutors say Anne shot her husband in the head and then recruited her grandson and Lori to help move the body. But after dragging the 240-pound man to the incinerator, it apparently wouldn't start, so they call Small, who, of course, called police. Semenovich was charged with first-degree murder and surprised the court by pleading guilty to manslaughter. She was sentenced to the minimum of 4 years in prison. For sale. One incinerator. Used only once. Recommended for disposing of objects less than 240 pounds. On to our next story with people who aren't quite clear on the concept. We go to San Pablo, California. Authorities in Northern California say a man released from a hospital after a psychiatric evaluation. And that should be a hint for you, shouldn't it? Anyway, he stole a taxi and tried to register it at a Department of Motor Vehicle office. Authorities tell the Contra Costa Times that 26-year-old Jermaine Gross was arrested on suspicion of auto theft and forgery. Gross had been sent to the county's regional medical center on an involuntary psychiatric hold. After his release, he shared a taxi with a woman who was going to a San Pablo hospital. Authorities say when they arrived, Gross asked the driver to help with the woman's luggage, then drove away in the yellow minivan. Gross was arrested after a DMV worker reported someone was using forged documents to register a cab. Okay, so now I'm just thinking, just how thorough was that psych evaluation that he had before he left the hospital? That's all I want to know. Okay, moving right along, we go to Seattle. Prosecutors in Washington state say a man was arrested when he was caught wheeling a 50-inch television in a shopping cart right past the police station. A bystander called 911 to report that she saw a man grab the TV off the back of a delivery truck, load it into a cart, and started to push it away. An Auburn police officer heard dispatchers relay the call as he was pulling into the police station parking lot, and then he saw the man, dressed entirely in camouflage, walking by with the cart. When the officer asked 22-year-old Jonathan D. Barnes what he was doing, he said he bought the TV from a friend, and then he ran. The officer caught up with Barnes and arrested him. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest on the program for the new year, Spanish police have detained a woman who faked her own kidnapping to test whether her husband would pay ransom, sending him a photograph of her with bound hands and feet. The man received the photo on his mobile phone from someone claiming to be one of the kidnappers, along with a text message demanding a ransom of 20,000 euros for her release. The ransom request was repeated in later text messages, as well as warnings that the man got not to go to police, which, of course, he ignored, and he went to police. Police launched a search and spotted her car, which they followed to a shopping mall in the town of Gandia on the Mediterranean coast. Here's a quote from the police statement. The woman, who was traveling alone and was in perfect health, was the supposed victim of the kidnapping. There you go. At first, she told police that she had been released that morning, but later confessed to faking her abduction to, quote, find out what her husband would be willing to do for her. Well, let's see now if he's willing to wait for her, because you know she's going to jail. By the way, what is it with women in Spain? In 2008, a Spanish court sentenced a woman to 3.5 years in prison after finding her guilty of extortion by faking her children's kidnapping 7 times. 7 times. Now, what I want to know is, who believed her after, say, the 3rd time? I'll give her the 1st one, maybe the 2nd one. But if your children keep getting kidnapped, or at least you keep reporting your children kidnapped, something tells me your kids aren't being kidnapped. 3rd time's a charm, as far as I'm concerned. She did this 7. I don't know. Maybe the Spanish cops aren't quite on the ball. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Alvin Titanic Thompson was a legendary gambler and con man. He is also the subject of an award-winning writer. Kevin Cook is the author of Titanic Thompson, The Man Who Bet on Everything. And Kevin joins us on the line right now. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Glad to be there.
This is an interesting character that I don't know if a lot of people know about, Alvin Titanic Thompson. How did you come to write this book, and what was interesting to you about this character?
Well, I think it is remarkable that he's not better known. I had heard about him down through the years, mostly from pro golfers. They tell old Titanic stories, especially the old-timers. Lee Trevino and Raymond Floyd knew him quite well and still trade Titanic stories. A lot of players on today's Champions Tour do. But it turns out that he was famous not only in golf, in which Ben Hogan called him the best shotmaker he'd ever seen. This is a man who used to play golf for $10,000 a hole while the best players in the world were playing for $1,000 a week. He was also a great poker player, a dice player who came in and cleaned out everybody in New York City in the Roaring Twenties, a man who killed 5 different men and married 5 women, all of whom were teenagers on their wedding days. So a really startling, striking figure, just blazing a trail through the 20th century.
And we should put the timeline. He was born in the late 19th century, died in 1974, correct?
That's right, and his heyday really was the 20s, right up through the 1950s and 60s. After that, you start to get into a world in which, say, the police know when he's coming to town, the next town, and the gamblers already know his name. It's not very good for someone like Titanic Thompson to be well known before he gets to town. His method was to come in and clean everybody out and be on his way to the next town down the road before anybody knew what had hit them. That's no longer possible in the 1960s and 70s. J. Edgar Hoover knew who he was and would let the local authorities know Titanic Thompson was coming to town.
It's interesting to note that I think early in his career, he came into contact with some of the same people that a fellow by the name of Enoch Johnson, who is now being serialized on the television series Boardwalk Empire as Nucky Thompson, came into contact with. Were they similar characters?
Well, they were. In fact, one of them was the exact same character, the great crime boss Arnold Rothstein, who ran rackets in New York City in the 20s during Prohibition. The young Rothstein is a character in Boardwalk Empire, really was crucially involved in organized crime in the 20s. Fellows like Meyer Lansky and Legs Diamond worked for Arnold Rothstein, and he was an inveterate gambler, loved to play dice, and had the underground craps games that Damon Runyon made famous in Guys and Dolls. Well, in 1928, just a little bit after Boardwalk Empire takes place, in the real 1928, Titanic Thompson rolls into town, wins everybody's money, including Rothstein's, playing dice. His philosophy was if you can't beat him, cheat him, so he would win in many different methods. And in poker, they wind up playing what the newspapers called the poker game of the century. Titanic Thompson double-crossed Arnold Rothstein. This is the man who had fixed the 1919 World Series, so this is big news at the time. And in the upshot of that big poker game, Arnold Rothstein gets shot and killed, and that becomes the trial that really helps to get Titanic in the newspapers.
Now, even if some people, and I'm talking about some older folks here now, aren't familiar with the name Titanic Thompson, they might be familiar with the character because he was immortalized in the past in musicals, was he not?
He sure was. And Damon Runyon, the writer who's Runyonesque is the word that was coined later to describe Runyon's New York, all the fedoras and the champagne and during Prohibition and the Jazz Age characters of those days. Damon Runyon wanted to write about the real Titanic Thompson and ask him if he could write his life story. Titanic said, "Mine ain't the kind of business publicity helps." So Runyon fictionalized him as Sky Masterson, the character Marlon Brando played in the movie of Guys and Dolls, the gambler hero of Guys and Dolls, and actually got the name from one of Titanic's sayings. Whenever somebody would say, "Ty, what's the limit in this poker game we're going to play?" he'd say, "Sky's the limit." Damon Runyon used that, named the character Sky Masterson. So he does get a revival all over the world from time to time as Sky Masterson.
Now, you started off by mentioning that that a lot of people on the pro golf circuit knew of Titanic Thompson and that he was a hustler, but he was also a relatively decent golf player. Why didn't he ever play on the pro tour himself?
Well, he was often asked that question, and Titanic would always say, "I couldn't afford the cut in pay." He was also a fellow who didn't want to be told when to get up, you know, get up in the morning and report to the first tee at 7 a.m. He would set up his own matches. But truly, the main reason he didn't play professional golf, as he probably would were he around today, was that he came in the generation before Ben Hogan and Byron Nelson, and there wasn't very much money to be made in professional golf. Those guys thought it was a big deal when they'd win $100 off each other just in a casual bet. The big money to be made was with confident high rollers, rich gullible suckers. These were Titanic's meat, and he would go to a particular town, find a man who loved to play big money golf and beat him by a stroke or even lose to him by a stroke, then get mad and say, "Look, we're going to play for 10 times as much, and I'll even play left-handed." Well, Titanic was naturally left-handed. He was a brilliant golfer either side, so when the bet was big enough, that's when he beat you.
Now, we seem to spend a lot of time, with the passage of time, romanticizing the con artists and cheats of our history. Do you think that in a time somewhere in the future we'll be looking at, say, some of the economic swindlers of the current day, much in the same way we look at some of the folks like Nucky Johnson and Titanic Thompson?
That's a good question. I think not, because the swindlers of today tend to be taking millions of dollars from anonymous people they don't even know, people who probably trusted, maybe mistrusted banks and other huge economic colossuses. And one thing that was true of Titanic and his ilk was they're only taking the money of guys who were trying to take their own money. He said, "I never suckered anybody. I never hustled anybody who wasn't trying to get into my wallet." So it was eyes open. And even if Titanic had a trick up his sleeve, there was a gambler's code that if he said, for instance, "I will win this bet because by saying that road sign that says Joplin 10 miles." Isn't really 10 miles, it's less than that to Joplin. Well, that was true, but that's because he had gotten up, rented a truck the night before, and moved the sign. So in those days, the gambler's code, rather than shoot a guy who did that, in good sportsmanship, you pay up and you get to bet the next time. It was a little bit worthy of romanticizing the craft of those guys, I think.
How did Alvin Clarence Thompson, get the nickname Titanic?
Well, he rolls into a pool hall in Joplin in 1912. This is just a few months after the Titanic sank, cleaned everybody out, also won a bet. There was a sign in the window that said $200 to anybody who can jump over our new pool table. Well, Titanic said that he could jump like a herd of bullfrogs. So he went and got a little mattress at a hotel down the way, bought that, put it on one side of the pool table, flips the pool table to win the money. Now he's got all the money from the pool players and from the proprietor. When the proprietor is asked, "What's that fellow's name?" he says, "I don't rightly know, but it ought to be Titanic because he sinks everybody." And even though Titanic's real last name was Thomas, he was misnamed by a reporter in New York City, Thompson, and liked the sound of that because it sounds like a Thompson submachine gun. Ever after, he was Titanic Thompson.
What happened to Titanic Thompson?
Well, he, like everyone else, I mean, the line is that every true gambler dies broke. And I think every real athletes tend to age and still believe they can do all the tricks that that they did in their heyday. I think Titanic, his skills eroded to some degree, and more than that, the world changed around him. He can't travel, he can't surprise people the way he used to. He still had that gambler spirit, so even when he didn't have a suitcase full of $100 bills, he would be hustling people in a nursing home for a nickel here and there. I think he was like the great gambler Nick the Greek in that way. He wound up playing for nickels in a bingo hall and said, "Hey, it's still action." I think that's one of the things about the great characters is that their character doesn't change. So while he wasn't playing for millions anymore, right to the end for Titanic, he was still right there to give you all you've got just to prove that he's the best player in the room.
I mentioned earlier how an HBO show like Boardwalk Empire brings to life the world of Nucky Johnson as Nucky Thompson. Do you foresee that type of treatment for this guy, this character, Titanic Thompson? Are there stories about him that would make an excellent television series?
Yeah, or a movie, certainly. It's one of the most cinematic lives that was ever spent. Very colorful. There's nothing better than the charmer who comes out of no place and just lines them up and takes them down, and then on to the next town he goes. There was a lot of romance. He had a whole Hollywood chapter in his life in which he pursued Howard Hughes, who was quite a golfer, as fans of The Aviator know. And Hughes was one of the people who turned out to be a little too smart to be suckered by Titanic, did not want to play golf against the man. Titanic wound up settling for a liaison with the bombshell Jean Harlow, and went on from Hollywood in those days. He spent time in Chicago with Al Capone. It's one of those stories that you really can't believe it until you get close to it and find out the facts about this legendary life.
A fascinating character indeed. The book is entitled Titanic Thompson, The Man Who Bet on Everything, and it's written by Kevin Cook. And Kevin, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Sure enjoyed it a lot, Peter. Thank you.
Kevin Cook, author of Titanic Thompson, The Man Who Bet on Everything. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0072, and you'll find links to Kevin's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're experiencing The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll learn about the website whereparentstalk.com. We'll also meet the luckiest sports fan alive, and of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day and lots more Stuff File news, like right here, right now. You know, it's really tough selling cars these days. The Cabral Chrysler dealership in Manteca, California was so desperate for a sale in October that one of its employees picked up potential customer Donald Davis, age 67, at his nursing home, brought the pajamas and slippers clad dementia suffering resident in to sign papers, handed him the keys to a new pickup truck, his own very pickup truck, by the way, complete with the requested chrome wheels, which I believe someone with dementia can still ask for the chrome wheels, and sent him on his way, even tossing Davis's wheelchair into the truck's bed as Davis sped away. Shortly afterward, Davis led police on a high-speed chase 50 miles from Manteca. He was stopped and detained, but at the hospital the next morning, he passed away from heart failure. Well, he certainly had an adventure, to say the least, didn't he? Went out with a bang. The Cabral salesman said Davis had called him twice the day before, insisting on buying a new truck. That's his story, and I'm sure he's sticking to it. Okay, now to help pay off the $8,000 he owed on his Cadillac, Kareem Spence, age 35, torched the car to collect the insurance money. Now, naturally, once investigators found gasoline-soaked towels in the trunk, they suspected arson and arrested Spence at the East Orange, New Jersey police headquarters. Spence was a police officer at the department for 4 years, but he was suspended and later resigned after his arrest. He pleaded guilty to insurance fraud and faces up to 5 years in prison. Now, if an experienced cop can't get away with it, you can pretty well guess and be sure that you never would. So when it comes to torching your car to get insurance money, let's just pass on the concept, shall we? Don't even try it. Okay, moving right along, it was all captured on a security camera in front of a pub in Crawley, West Sussex, England. One man threw bricks through the glass door to make a hole, and the second man tossed a lit firebomb into the hole, but the second man missed, and the bomb bounced right back, landing right where the first man was crouching, and exploded into a fireball. Neither man received significant injury, surprisingly enough, and once they recovered from the shock, they turned to run, and the second man ran right into a light pole, knocking him to the ground. When he went to a clinic for treatment for his injuries, police made the caller. Despite the surveillance video evidence, Amir Ali, age 28, denied being involved, but nevertheless, he was convicted. Police still don't know who the other man is. Surely there's a lamppost out there with his name on it. These guys were almost the idiots of the day. Almost. But they're not. That comes later. Okay, here's a recent trend in crime that I just don't understand because nobody ever gets away with it. Police in Florida say they followed a trail of debris from a credit union to a suspect in a front-end loader carrying an ATM ripped from the building. Jacksonville police said they responded to a burglar alarm at around 3:50 a.m. and discovered the Vistar credit union structure had been demolished and an ATM was missing. Investigators followed a trail of debris to a Caterpillar front-end loader attempting to turn from a highway onto a bike trail. They said the driver of the loader kept going despite police turning on their lights, then put the heavy machine into reverse and headed straight for a patrol car. The police car evaded the machine, and again it tried to flee. It fled away, but stopped after about 500 feet, and police arrested Robert Anderson, age 31. Police said the ATM was severely damaged, but its cash cartridge remained intact, because they always do. Anderson was jailed on charges of burglary in excess of $1,000 and aggravated assault. Again, like I say, people are always trying to steal ATMs by literally ripping them right out of the wall, and I never see the point in this. They never get away with it. But I digress. Anyway, on to our last story before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And it's a story that harkens back to recent Christmas season that just passed by. 10 boys at Battlefield High School in Haymarket, Virginia, formed the Christmas Sweater Club. Now, each wore the wildest holiday-themed sweater they could find, and when they arrived at the school, they sang Christmas carols and tossed 2-inch candy canes to other students. Seems pretty harmless, don't you think? Well, as you know, school these days can be a real buzzkill. School administrators put an immediate stop to the cheer. They said the candy canes are weapons because, wait for it, you can sharpen them with your mouth and then stab people with them. That's what the school administrators said. I'm not making this up. At least that's what the school administrators told Skylar Torbett, a junior who added that no one tried to use the candy as a weapon. They said maliciously maim students with the intent to injure, confirmed a perplexed Zach Ryan, who's also a junior. I don't think any of us here intentionally meant to injure anyone or did. Still, administrators gave the boys each a detention and also cleaning duties. Again, I say buzzkill. Absolute buzzkill. You know, one has to wonder about how stable someone is if they dream up ways of using candy canes as lethal weapons. What kind of childhood or school days did these administrators have that they're thinking that kids are going to use candy canes merely as weapons? Remember the good old days when candy canes were just, oh, I don't know, candy? Yes. Anyway. Let's just get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? For moms and dads, there is a great online resource called WhereParentsTalk.com. It's the brainchild of two broadcast veterans who are also working moms. Joining us on the program right now is one of the founders, Leanne Castellino. Hi, Leanne.
Hi, Peter.
Nice to have you on the program. So you started this along with Andrea Howick, who's another broadcast veteran. And you were both working moms, and you decided to do Where Parents Talk. What made you start this?
Well, we started originally as a company that produced parenting DVDs because we felt that there weren't really any credible, trustworthy video resources for parents. And in keeping with the technology and the evolving technologies, we've now moved into an online parenting community that has no borders, which is fantastic. So we have all kinds of wonderful ways for parents to reach out on our site. They can watch video clips. There's forums, there's chats, there's all kinds of useful information for parents on our website. And what we've done is basically done the research for parents because, as we all know, there's a ton of different websites out there. But how do you know which ones to trust? Well, as broadcast journalists and as moms, we've kind of done the research for parents out there, and we've put it on our site for them to access.
Was this a situation where necessity is the mother of invention? Was it a case where both of you were looking for information because at the time, I'm guessing you were relatively new moms yourself and you wanted this information and couldn't find it or trust it?
That's exactly right, Peter. In fact, it started because I was taking prenatal classes and they were showing us videos, this is about 14 years ago, that were outdated and that just did not apply anymore to the standards of the time. And I thought, you know what, why can't we make something that's credible and current? And that's how the video component started, and now it has evolved into this online community. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing for parents to be able to exchange and share and discuss parenting issues, because as those of us who are parents know, there is no shortage of information, and we all crave it because it's a very different generation of parenting today, for sure, with all the information that is available, not only to parents, but to their children as well.
And one of the things when I checked out the website whereparentstalk.com is that when you go to a lot of sites, sometimes, let's be honest, dads can be forgotten, but not on your site.
No, we went about it because we wanted to really give dads a voice and a space. And it's true, they do often get overshadowed. And one of the things we've learned over the years is that, you know, dads are definitely interested in how their children are raised. They might not always show it in the same ways as the moms do, but they, you know, they certainly still care. And so we have a part of our site, whereparentstalk.com, that is dedicated to dads. And we get a lot of feedback from dads saying, you know, thanks very much for including me. Thanks for making video clips because that's how I learn best. All kinds of great feedback from them, and they certainly feel included on the site.
In the time that's since you started this, you get a lot of input, I'm sure, from people who watch the work that you do. Has it changed in any way the focus or some of the direction? Like, have you learned things from people who are asking questions that you thought, I didn't think of that one?
Absolutely, and that's the beauty of a site like this, and certainly about the beauty of being a parent as well, is that you're constantly evolving and learning with each age and stage of your child's growth. So I've got three children, 13, 11, and 6, and Andrea has three kids, 9, 7, and 4. And, you know, the span of those ages, I mean, we're constantly asking questions of ourselves. Am I making the right decision? Am I doing the right thing for my child who's 6 or my child who's 9? And this is a great way to get that information because there are tons of other people out there with similar questions, and this gives them a forum to be able to exchange and share and, you know, maybe discover things that you never thought about, and some shortcuts that all parents are always looking for, definitely, is something that we've learned through this site.
And I'm guessing that some of the things that the two of you have learned with 6 children between you is the fact that even if something works for one 9-year-old, it doesn't necessarily work for another 9-year-old or a 9-year-old of another gender. Each child is individual.
Yes, for sure. And that's the thing, though, is that you can never use one, you know, stroke to paint each and every child. But that's something that you learn through connecting with other parents, that, you know, you can't fit them into the mold that you've created. You've got to kind of evolve with them. But that also comes with getting more information and understanding what else is out there. And again, it's the information that you can trust and that is credible, and that's what we seek to find for parents.
So let's talk about the site itself. How often is it updated? How often are new features added to the site, whereparentstalk.com?
It is updated fairly frequently. It's got new videos. So one of the things that we're really concerned about is nutrition, for example. So we've got a series of new nutrition videos up there. And everything that's ever been posted is archives, so you can go and take a look at the old videos that have been posted as well. Another new component is that we have started a new television show, which we will be putting excerpts of the show on the site, and the show is called Parents Talk, and that will be up on the site as well. I try very much as possible, to blog on a regular basis, as does Andrea. It's not always easy when you're running around after three children. But, yeah, the site is it's a massive site. It's got a lot of components to it, but we do try to update it at least several times a week.
And beyond the site, as you said, it started with a whole series or with a DVD, but you now have a series of DVDs, is that correct?
Yeah, we have two DVDs. The second one is all about nutrition for babies and toddlers. And what's unique about this DVD is that it really talks about how to start your children eating right from the very first time they start eating solid foods. And that's very important, because now we've got this obesity epidemic in North America and beyond, and a lot of people are trying to change their eating habits or the eating habits of their families and their teens or their older children. And then the message of this DVD, which is called Yummy in My Tummy, is all about start them eating right from the very first moment, and hopefully you'll have a better chance of success. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do with this site, is to give parents recipe demonstrations and, you know, simple healthy recipes that they can make for their families and also prepare with their children if they're brave enough to cook with their children.
So the site itself, too, first of all, with the DVDs, how does one get their hands on the DVDs?
The DVDs are available at major retailers in both Canada and the U.S., and they're also available online. So we, you know, we tap into borders beyond North America, and also, again, available at retailers and institutional distributors as well. So if you're a library or your school, and we have a lot of those types of clients as well, that are using the DVDs as teaching tools and resources for their clientele, we can have them distributed through our distributors.
And getting back to the website for a moment, whereparentstalk.com, I believe one of the things you also have, besides the articles and recipes and videos, you have forums and also live chats?
We do, and that's something that we're just working to start developing. It's a very dynamic site. There's a lot of components to it, and that's one of the things certainly in the new year that we're going to try to work on more, is the chat and forum, just to, again, get the exchange with parents going. We have a Twitter presence. We also have a Facebook presence as well. And so it's all, you know, it's growing quite rapidly.
So it sounds like the site is one-stop shopping for all parents out there, both moms and dads.
It really is. I mean, parenting isn't what it used to be. I mean, you can talk to parents today, and it's a lot of questioning of am I making the right decision about, you know, telling my child this, or should I let them be on the internet, or are they old enough to date, and, you know, should I be feeding them strawberries if they've got allergies when they're under two? I mean, there's a whole host of different questions that parents have on a daily basis, and it's really nice to be encouraged, supported, reassured, that you are making the right decisions, or that your questions, whatever they may be, that you have a place to go to get them answered.
And it's a great site, and it's easy to navigate. The site is called whereparentstalk.com. And Leanne, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thanks very much, Peter.
Leanne Castellino from whereparentstalk.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0072, and you'll find links to their website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones. So how are your New Year's resolutions going? Hopefully you haven't broken as many as I have. Sometimes I think we make resolutions that are just a little too hard to keep, so I'd like to suggest one that would actually be fun and easy. It goes like this. I resolve to enter the Wacky Warning Label contest this year so I can win the $1,000 grand prize. Sounds fun, right? Well, it is, and the best part is that these warning labels are all around you. I'll bet some of the gifts you received over the holidays have labels that would be perfect for our contest. Now, let's be fair. We know why there are so many wacky warning labels today. Frivolous lawsuits. They cost all of us a lot of money, and it's not fair. That's why we're working to put common sense back to work in the courts. But for now, one of these labels could win you $1,000 if you enter our contest. So before you throw out all those users' manuals and boxes, read them closely. Find out how you can enter to win one of the cash prizes in our contest by going to my website at bobderigojones.com.
What are they saying about if the rains don't cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. Listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the luckiest sports fan alive, and we'll also have an idiot of the day. Before we get to those points, a couple more Stuff File stories to share with you, including one dealing with the entrepreneurial spirit. Wei Xingpeng is 55 years old. He's a boatman in a village near the industrial town of Lanzhou, China, and he collects bodies from the Yellow River. You know, the murdered, the suicides, the accidentally drowned. And he offers them back to the grieving relatives for a price. Distraught visitors pay a small browsing fee to check his inventory. Ooh. And then, if they identify a loved one, up to the equivalent of $500 to take the corpse home. Says Wei, I bring dignity to the dead. Now that's no overstatement for him, since his own son drowned in the river, and his body has never been recovered. Meanwhile, in November, at a burglary scene near Seneca, South Carolina, deputies found Noah Smith, age 31, naked and apparently drugged, perhaps on hallucinogenic mushrooms, and with a string-like object protruding from his buttocks. Smith was x-rayed, revealing, according to the deputy's report, which of course made its way onto the internet, that the object in his rectum was a mouse. However, several days later, the sheriff's office clarified that the object was a computer mouse. Smith told emergency room personnel that he had no memory of the incident. Wow, you'd think some things would be kind of hard to forget. Wouldn't you like to be in the room the second that flashback of realization hits him? The look on his face should be priceless. Anyway, let's get to our last guest on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Shergul Arshad is a major sports fan. He's a sports fanatic, and he's the author of 40 by 40, The Luckiest Sports Fan Alive. Hi, Shergul.
Hello, everybody.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So you've written this book. It's almost like, shall we say, a bucket list for the under 40 crowd.
Yeah, it's sort of a to-do list of sporting events in a lifetime. I've just been lucky enough to get it all done by age 40.
Okay. Now, let's back up a little bit. You originally came to the United States from Italy.
Yeah, so I'm originally from Florence, Italy. I was born over there and moved to the U.S. when I was 11, to the Boston area. And it wasn't very hard to hook on to the Boston sports scene, what with Larry Bird and the Celtics doing well. But I maintained, of course, my first love, which was soccer, and went back that summer for the 1982 World Cup and watched with my buddies as Italy won, and that started a long love affair with the Italian soccer team.
Okay, so you came to the United States with, a knowledge of soccer, but not a knowledge of North American sports. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's actually extremely correct, and as a social way to fit in, you know, as an 11-year-old, 12-year-old, it's really sports and music and not much else. It's before kind of girls kick in, so the other two subjects were music and sports, so I took a crash course on both and hooked on with sports for sure.
Okay, so let's flash forward a little bit. You've put together this book, which which are I guess, the travels that you've done in going to major sporting events through the United States. How did that start for you?
Well, in high school, I was fortunate that my dad got a couple tickets to World Series Game 5, Red Sox Mets. And again, this was before I had any control in my life, and I experienced the great sort of feeling of October with everything. The hot dogs and popcorn tasted better, and there were celebrities everywhere, and there was just an electricity to the crowd. And so when I finished college, I really focused on trying to either work in situations where I could go to sporting events or combine it with work travel. And also really, you know, the book is written such that it's not about some guy spending all kinds of money to go to events or a guy who has all kinds of press passes. It's about a regular fan who definitely makes his own luck. In other words, we all come across, you know, thousands of people during the course of a lifetime. I've been the type of guy that has fostered relationships and made great friendships, and some of those friendships have obviously had some great success and are able to procure tickets. And so, you know, it's not just a one-way street where you ask for tickets to a Super Bowl and expect to do nothing in return, but you don't have to reciprocate with tickets. You might be able to reciprocate by offering your place in Boston for a week or sending the guy's wife a spa gift certificate.
Okay, but there's luck, and then there's luck. I mean, 6 Super Bowls, 5 World Cups, 4 World Series, 3 NBA Finals, 3 Major League Baseball All-Star Games, 2 Olympics, 4 a Final Four, a Masters, Stanley Cup Finals. I know there's others I'm missing. There's a long list here.
Well, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head. I've been definitely on the luckiest side. I went from lucky to luckiest probably this past decade as the Boston sports teams really started to take off, and, you know, Patriots winning 3 Super Bowls. I've been a season ticket holder for 16 years. And so whether it's contacts within the organization, but mostly I have a good friend of mine who runs marketing for U.S. Track and Field, and he's able to get 2 tickets every year, and he's not a Patriots fan. So, you know, I am glad to take them off his hands, so to speak. And I've been able to leverage that network and friendship to get to a bunch of these Super Bowls. And then, you know, as you pointed out, World Cups, I actually worked as a volunteer for the 1994 World Cup here in North America, here in Boston, actually. I was the Italian team's translator and spent every day at practice, and ultimately culminated in me practicing with the Italian national team. So I think there's some neat stories there. It's very analogous to a Canadian kid getting the shot to practice every day with the Canadian Olympic hockey team.
Exactly. For whom did you write this book for?
I'd say there's multiple audiences. I think every sports fan, to some extent, you know, has this in that mythical list of things they'd love to do, maybe even just a couple of these once in a lifetime. And I really wrote it primarily for those folks, because when they read this, they'll realize that this wasn't a guy, you know, dropping $5,000 to buy tickets, or a guy who's, you know, really connected in the media, but a guy who's just leveraging, you know, all kinds of connections to make his own luck. And hopefully a few of these folks get off the couch and say, hey, I can do this too. And the other audience, of course, was more on a memoir for family, friends, and keepsake for my kids.
I think one of the important points in all of this is the fact that if you are passionate about a particular sport, you can find a creative way to being a part of that sport if you really want to.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I think so many people just assume from the get-go, well, it's going to be prohibitive to get there, the tickets are going to be too much, so I'm just going to stay at home. That's the easy way out, right? There's high-definition televisions, and you know, why bother with the hassles? But let me tell you, there's nothing like experiencing a big event live. I got to go to the 2002 Olympics as an example, and you know, so many tickets end up shaking out right in front of the stadiums. We ended up going to see Canada, Belarus, as well as the U.S. Russia semifinals of hockey. But you know, the story is really putting yourself in that situation. So my advice to fans, and as they read the book, they'll get some of this, is, you know, first of all, to just go there map out potentially who you know in a city who can help you find a cheaper arrangement or maybe even host you, arrange the airfare that maybe you can refund or transfer later on. And then tickets for the big events end up shaking out oftentimes minutes before a game, or if you've leveraged connections, you'll get them, you know, the week before the game.
Would it be fair to say that the lessons learned and the ones that can be culled from your book could be applied to other passions that one might have, or also job-related situations?
No doubt about it. I think I've been successful in my job, which is primarily business development executive, working on online commerce, but previously I was in the advertising industry, largely because I'm a social networker. This is long before Facebook, but obviously since Facebook as well. I enjoy coming in contact with people and maintaining and cultivating that relationship. So whether that's done for a work purpose or concert tickets or finding a place to stay when you're over in Europe, you know, there's personal and professional overlaps. I think that this book does weave the story of my life for 40 years across 40 major sporting events, not just partaking as a spectator, but participating in some instances.
Now, you say you have kids. How old are they?
I have two boys, 9 and 7.
Okay. And do you see any of them in the way that they might follow through on some of the things that you have done?
It's probably too early to tell. And I remember myself as a 9 and 7 year old. I was, you know, too busy riding my bike or playing with Star Wars figures. My boys are into Pokemon and the Wii. They are both young soccer players. I coach them in soccer. And this past summer, sort of the last chapter of my book was culminating in a family trip where we used all kinds of miles, but also went off to South Africa and took in the World Cup and went on a safari. And they had such a good time, not just on safari, but at the games themselves. I think we might have a couple of budding soccer fans.
Oh, the reason why I say that is again, the creative spirit that you had in going through your life as a sports fan is not something that starts with just sports. It starts with other things as well. And I'm just wondering if that entrepreneurial spirit that you had manifests itself in other ways before you got into sports, and if you see that in your children.
No doubt about it. Actually, there's a funny anecdote. When I was earlier in high school, I was over on a exchange student trip to Russia. I studied Russian. And my friend Dan and I, we were entrepreneurial to the fact that all throughout high school, we were finding creative ways to get baseball player autographs, whether it was at the dugout or after a game at a hotel. And we got to Russia and we saw a bunch of guys walking around with Billy Joel concert passes. And we, as 15, 16-year-olds, were able to negotiate a couple of pair of jeans for 4 front row tickets. So bartering and making a deal has always been essential. I see my kids now doing things like trading video games or trading Pokemon, and perhaps some negotiations and deal-making skills are already apparent.
Yeah, there you go. The book is called 40 by 40, The Luckiest Sports Fan Alive, 40 True Sports Adventures Before the Age of 40. Shergul Arshad, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
I appreciate it very much. And for all of those folks getting holiday gift certificates on Amazon, you know, the book is available on Amazon. You can find out more about it at www.40x40sports.com. That's the number 40x40sports.com.
Shergul Arshad, author of 40 by 40, The Luckiest Sports Fan Alive. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0072, and you'll find links to his website and links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We have time for one more item on the show, and that would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
A man has been hospitalized after police in South Carolina say he was hit by an SUV while playing a real-life version of the video game Frogger. Authorities said the 23-year-old man was taken to a hospital in Anderson after he was struck at around 9 p.m. In the Frogger arcade game, players move frogs through traffic on a busy road and through a hazard-filled river. Before he was hit, police say the man had been discussing the game with his friends. Chief Jimmy Dixon said the man yelled, "Go!" and darted into oncoming traffic in the four-lane highway. No charges are expected against the driver. The name of the man who was struck has not been released. And it doesn't make a difference whether his name is released or not, because on this show, we already have a name for him. That name would be Idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0072. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, and you'll find on the Stuff File website all the information and links on our guest by going to the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0072. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PAholder, and on Twitter at twitter.com/PAholder. Don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.